This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. In about 2 months, we will elect America's next president and commander-in-chief. North Carolina could play a key role in that decision because we're a battleground state. That seems fitting for a different reason as well. This state is home to the third largest military population in the country and the most populous U.S. military base in the world, Fort Bragg. These are people living in a battleground state who can be called to fight on real battlegrounds. For them, the choosing of a commander-in-chief must seem particularly important, and especially so considering the winner will be our third wartime president in a row. So this hour, we hear from some policy and security experts on just what the next president might face in this second decade of our war on terror, as well as trouble spots that may be simmering in the background, but which might boil over in the next 4 years. Dr. Cindy Combs is a professor of political science at UNC Charlotte, on whose Middle East expertise we relied heavily upon in the aftermath of the 9/11 attack. Welcome back. Good to see you again.
Good to be here, Mike.
Dr. Combs is with us in our studio, and joining us by phone is Dr. Peter Fever, professor of political science and public policy at Duke University and the director of the Triangle Institute for Security Studies. Thanks for being here as well.
Thank you for inviting me.
When communism collapsed, many people thought that the world would now be safe for democracy, and conflicts would be a thing of the past, and the specter of nuclear war would be gone forever, and all would be well. And that lasted about 20 minutes. It's proven not to be the case. When communism fell, was anybody predicting the kind of dangers that we face now, particularly from terrorists rather than from nation states? Dr. Fever.
Well, there were warnings that with the collapse of the bipolar system, this is now going back 25 years, that the collapse of the bipolar system of just the U.S. versus the Soviets, that it would produce a more unstable multipolar system, more great powers vying with each other, harder to predict. There were predictions of that sort 25 years ago, but there wasn't as a crystal ball that clearly predicted the kinds of threats that we're wrestling with today. However, what's interesting is that in the last several years, we're seeing a return to great power rivalry of the sort that we hadn't seen for most of the post-Cold War era, the rise of Putin in Russia and the rise of Xi in China, and the assertive foreign policies that both have pursued, has meant that the next president will be looking at great power threats in addition to the transnational, subnational threats that have dominated the news over the last several decades.
I remember in our many conversations that we had on this program post 9/11, Dr. Combs, that one of the running themes at the time seemed to have been surprise that somebody hated us that much that they would do this to us, and surprise that they had that kind of power, and surprise that nobody was looking out for it, or it seemed that we were caught off guard. As a Middle East expert, were you caught off guard?
Yes, because although we were aware as a culture that we were in less danger than we had been when you were dealing with a mutual assured destruction type of system, nobody expected there to be, I mean, terrorism is not new. It didn't just start, and it didn't just start with 9/11, and it didn't simply start 25 years ago. Mm-hmm. But it had not, for the U.S. at home, had not been a critical issue. Even with the federal bombing in 95, that was not a wake-up that says terrorism is suddenly a dramatic security, national security interest. Mm-hmm. Our problem was that we got complacent with the idea that we don't have that large worry anymore. So we stopped looking for anything really bad from small flare-up points. We ignored the anger and the building. You had 93, you had an attack on the World Trade Center by the same group that hit us in 2001. Mm. We have no excuse for not being aware of a problem. We just did not see the magnitude come.
It seems that every president in recent history, and this is just my anecdotal memory, so it could be completely wrong, and you can correct me because you're the political scientists here, but it seems like every presidential race in recent history, the president runs or the candidates run campaigning for certain things, and they get into office and they don't get to do those things because something comes up that no one thought about, that no one anticipated. Is it really possible from our vantage point, to predict exactly where dangers will arise, where things that the next president must handle right now will occur?
It is possible, because none of these things happen out of a vacuum. They didn't just become overnight problems. Syria wasn't an overnight problem. We just didn't see it. Until we do a better job of assessing the different areas and the anger and the dislocation of people, the Syrian refugees have made us more aware of people who are displaced. But it's not only Syria that's had a lot of displaced people. So unless we become aware of the potential in something, and we can't afford, in other words, to wait until it blows up in our face.
Right.
So it's not a matter of we can't predict, but our predictions can't be based on who's got a nuclear weapon and is aiming at us. And it can't simply be predict on who is making the loudest or largest statements against us. You've got to be able to look below, because al-Qaeda was making statements before 9/11. We weren't listening. There were statements made that were clearly captured, but we never saw it as an important part.
Peter, you were director for defense policy and arms control on the National Security Council at the White House, where you dealt with nuclear arms control, strategic review, and other defense policy issues. You served both Presidents Clinton and George W. Bush. If you were back at the White House today or in the next presidency, would you be, or would someone else be, concentrating on those issues, or would the focus have shifted to ISIS or rogue homegrown threats? In other words, what you faced 8 years ago, 12 years ago, are they completely different from what they would be today?
There are some differences. So cybersecurity is far more prominent a concern today than it was a decade ago when I was working in the Bush administration, or 2 decades ago when I was in the Clinton administration. But I'd answer your larger question this way. When the next bad thing happens, if we look backwards, we'll be able to find some intelligence warning about it. The problem is not that we're not warned about things. The problem is that we're warned about too many things, including many, many things that don't happen. President Obama and his team have been successful in blocking many terrorist attacks that would have been front page news and catastrophic had they happened, but they were thwarted. And you don't get the credit for successes like that in same proportion for the blame you get when one of them slips through.
Well, part of that is we don't know what the threats were, and we'll never know what the threats were, and it's hard to prove a negative.
Exactly. The counterfactual is very difficult. But let me just give you a couple examples. A lot of experts have been very worried about North Korean nuclear program.
Right.
And frankly, we have a 2-decade record of bipartisan failure in stopping the North Korean nuclear program. It's the crisis most likely to arise in the first 90 days of the next president's administration. We're on that trajectory. When it happens, people will say, how in the world could this have happened? You know, this is so far away from Syria, ISIL, what things we've been talking about. But in fact, experts have been worrying about it tremendously. It's just a very, very difficult problem to solve. And the policy tools that are available to presidents are unsatisfying because they have downsides associated with them.
Well, let's talk about that, because we do talk a lot about the Middle East and about terrorism and about ISIS in particular these days. But Cindy Combs, you stressed that what's going on in North Korea is far more disturbing.
It is, because we're making serious efforts, as he's pointed out, through multiple presidents to try to be able to resolve, and have not been able to do it. We've been able to do sanctions. We've had efforts to be able to have political diplomacy. We don't trade with North Korea, so it's very difficult to make sanctions work unless its major trading partner, which is the People's Republic of China, agrees and cooperates with that effort. And it's not happening, because, again, North Korea does not threaten China in any specific way, and therefore would not be a logical reason for them to say, you worry us and we'll cooperate to try to shut you down. So you've also got a 33-year-old president there that's the youngest world president, with no real experience and a lot of the emotion that goes with young people who are excited and angry.
And Madeleine Albright has called him on this program crazy.
He is, in a lot of ways. In Western terms, he is. In terms of his own culture, he's also a person who's worshipped by his people. In North Korea, he's not only the supreme leader, he is the replacement for God on earth.
Right.
So therefore, there's no one challenging. Can you imagine being 33 and ruling everybody in a country and having them all worship you with signs of you everywhere? Look what that would do to your rationality.
Well, over the weekend, Kim Jong-un launched a nuclear or did a nuclear test in North Korea. Is he completely uncontrollable? What powers do we have? Can China reel him in? What could we do to reel him in? He obviously is autonomous and he's a little tiger in his little fiefdom. What are our options other than bombing them to kingdom come?
Well, the problem is that China is more afraid of North Korean collapse than they are of North Korea's nuclear arsenal.
Why?
Because if North Korea collapses, then they will have hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions, of displaced North Koreans on their border, perhaps crossing their border, and a refugee crisis for them that it looks like the refugee crisis caused by the Syrian civil war.
Why wouldn't we have something like the reunification of Germany after the fall of the wall? Well, why wouldn't we have that with South Korea?
We'll get to that, but that's okay. I just listed the first problem is the immediate humanitarian disaster. The second disaster is all of the loose nukes and chemical weapons that the arsenal and perhaps biological weapons that the North Koreans have assembled will be have to be secured, and that the utmost national security priority will be getting our hands on those so that they don't go missing in the chaos. And of course, China will be very worried about that because it's right on their border. So when they look at North Korea, they say we'd rather manage this guy and a intact state then deal with the chaos that would come if we squeeze the state so hard that it cracks. And so we're left with not being able to put enough pressure on North Korea to get them to change their calculus. Now, the long-term solution is precisely the one you identify. In the long run, the wealthy South will have to absorb the poor North and create a single economy, single polity, a single society, as was done in between East and West Germany. It can be done, but it's enormously expensive. And East Germany was far more advanced politically and socially than North Korea is. So the gap is just so much larger.
And Germany went through a period of instability because of that reunification. This would be probably greater on a scale of many magnitudes, wouldn't it?
It would, and East Germany did not have a large nuclear arsenal that had to be managed in the process.
In North Korea, aren't you also dealing with people who are immensely, hopelessly poor, but also brainwashed, and we assume that they see him as a god. Maybe they're just acting because they know they have to.
It's less a matter of brainwashed than we are socialized. Every person grows up in a system that socializes them in directions of understanding what to do, right and wrong, who to listen to. You're not brainwashed, but you are socialized. If you have a system that for now two or three generations, it's third generation at least, that is socialized to believe that the decisions made by the supreme leader are good, you don't question that.
Yes, Hillary Clinton has said something about North Korea, which I want to tell you in a moment. You probably already know it, but I want to find out if that's a statement that's credible and it can actually be followed through on. We're talking to Dr. Cindy Combs from UNC Charlotte and Dr. Peter Fever from Duke University. We're coming right back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Donaltac Diamonds, hosting a trunk show featuring two collections from Alex Sepkus and Sadie Couture, September 22nd through the 24th in their location at Moorcroft Village, South Park. Details at donaltac.com. And members of the 22nd Annual Festival of India, Saturday and Sunday at the Belk Theater and outdoors at Trade and Tryon in Uptown. Family-friendly event, including Indian food, art, and more. Details at indiafestival.net. The Miracle on the Hudson has worked its way back into the public consciousness. That's the U.S. Airways flight that landed in the Hudson River with all the passengers and crew surviving. It's been made into the new movie Sully. And since so many of the passengers were from Charlotte, the film's debut kind of provides an opportunity to revisit that flight in a conversation with some of the passengers from the Carolinas Aviation Museum, which is home to the actual aircraft. We'll do that tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, members of more than 200 Native American tribes expand protests over the construction of a controversial oil pipeline from North Dakota to Illinois. What's next in the fight over the Dakota Access Pipeline and renewed debate over tribal rights?
That conversation on the Diane Rehm Show following Charlotte Talks from 10 to noon here on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the crises or bubbling up points, the situations that the next president may face around the world with Dr. Peter Feaver, a professor of political science at Duke University, director of the Triangle Institute for Security Studies, and someone who worked with the National Security Council in both the Bill Clinton and George W. Bush presidencies. Dr. Cindy Combs with us, professor for political science and an expert in the Middle East at UNC Charlotte. Hillary Clinton has said, we're talking about Korea at the moment, however, Hillary Clinton has said that she would make it very clear, this is a quote, that the U.S. won't allow North Korea to have a deliverable nuclear weapon. Is that a statement that an American president or a candidate for president can make with confidence? What would it take to be confident in that prediction?
Well, that is a very high bar to clear. And what she's talking about is the combination of a nuclear weapon, one, two, a nuclear weapon that is small enough that it can fit atop a missile, and three, an ICBM, an intercontinental ballistic missile that's large enough to carry that payload and accurate enough to deliver it. And we know that North Korea is working on all three of those at the same time. They've cleared the first bar. The test over the weekend, they claimed to have cleared the second bar. It's experts are debating whether they've cleared it, but they're definitely getting close. And then they are making steady progress on the third, and it's just a matter of time. And this is when I said this crisis will come up on the next watch. The trend lines of development intersect in the next presidency, that it's likely that North Korea will cross that threshold sometime in the next 4 years. And so that what she's talking about is a international crisis, it would take a military strike to prevent that, or it would take North Korea to voluntarily surrender the progress that they've made, and it's hard to imagine them doing that without facing a lot more economic pressure than they're facing now.
During the Cold War, I guess one of the major reasons we didn't have a nuclear incident was because of mutual destruction, the assurance of mutual destruction. If somebody launched a missile, they were going to launch two more at us, or vice versa. Surely Kim Jong-un, as crazy as he might be, knows that if he gains the capability of launching a nuclear missile that could hit the west coast of the United States, which people say he will have perhaps in 10 years, that if he did that, that would be the end of North Korea. Surely he knows that.
Well, he would argue, if you had him on his show, that he already faces that kind of threat from the United States because the U.S. has nuclear weapons, and he believes that those nuclear weapons are targeted on his state. And the reason that he wants to develop the nuclear arsenal is to deter our attacks on him. But your point is, if he were to take out Los Angeles, the retaliation from the U.S. would be to destroy everything that is in North Korea. And that's how the war plans might go. But the question is, would that deter somebody who views himself as God on earth, as Cindy said, who is viewed that way by a significant number of the elite, perhaps, around him, and who might conclude that this is a better way to go than the slow collapse and starvation. So there's still reason to worry about it, and the blithe confidence that deterrence will work with this crazy leader because it worked with other crazy leaders, that's a risk policymakers are very reluctant to make.
The assumption that a rational decision will come from Kim is just not real. He has not made rational decisions given everything from the starving of his people by the sanctions he allowed to continue because he won't step back, to the statements he's made about effectively that this would, if in fact this occurs, this would glorify him forever as the one who challenged and successfully challenged the U.S. with its own weapons systems. So there's a sense in which you can't expect a rational answer.
Is this a problem that we need and should rely on China to help solve? Or are we the only player that can really bring this under control?
I don't think anyone alone can bring it under control. You need China. There's no question because they are the closest. They're a powerful country. They're the major trading partner.
Well, how likely is that to happen, given the enormous problems that we face with China itself and their maneuvers in the South China Sea and their own enormous population, their gargantuan military? How likely are they to be on our side in most of this?
It's not a matter of threatening China. It's a matter of economics. China needs a world market, and their access into the World Trade Center and the ability to use that world market is critical to their survival. Mm-hmm. They are this is one where you would make deals, or you would make, in effect, agreements that say you step here a little further, and we'll step back here a little further in order to give you. You can't afford to trade away the Spratly Islands in terms of having North Korea step down, but you can, in effect, change the pressure point.
China also holds, if I'm not mistaken, a great deal of U.S. debt. Are they likely to rattle our cage given that? They seems to me that they would be careful because they want to get that money back.
Yes, they do. They're not willing to just rattle. Rattling the cage assumes that they're going to try to sell off some of it and make us worry. Mm-hmm. But they can't afford to lose the money. They're right now, they have expanded in order to be able to industrialize to the point of building areas where they're theoretically going to be industrial bases, and they haven't expanded the way they needed to.
One of our problems in the Middle East is that we simply don't we're not equipped to understand the culture and all of the undercurrents that go through that culture, from the difference between Shia and Sunni to many, many, many other things. Do we understand the Chinese culture any better?
I think we do understand them better. The problem is that there's a lack of overlap on our interests. It's not a one-to-one overlap. Let me put it that way. They intersect at some points. They would prefer to see North Korea without a nuclear weapon. And so they are willing to put some pressure on North Korea and cooperate with us to a certain extent to do that. But they're not willing to put enough pressure on North Korea that would put the state in jeopardy of cracking. They do not want to when North Korea engaged in very destabilizing activity and sank a South Korean ship and also was disrespectful to China in a number of diplomatic settings, China responded by squeezing North Korea more tightly than they had hitherto. So they did cut back on some of the cross-border trade. And this was an indication of how that China would try to discipline its junior partner to a certain extent. But they eased up on the pressure, and they were not willing to go all the way to actually forcing Kim Jong-un into backing down.
A moment ago, Cindy Combs, we were talking about the amount of money that we owe to China and the fact that's maybe helping us to keep the thing in perspective because they want to get paid back. But you have said that economic instability in Asia is a greater threat to America than the Middle East.
Economically, we have a great deal more trade with Asia than we do with the Middle East. We have trade there and we have interests there, but they're not translated usually into money terms. So there's a sense in which it depends on whether you're worried about national security. Are our security interests more economic? Are they more political in terms of where our allies are and who we care about there? You realize that before the end of the Cold War, we had translated national security into East-West conflicts and not triggering something that would be a world war. Mm-hmm. Now we're having to make our the last 20 years, we've had to make a much broader assessment of what security means. And we're adding economics into it. And that makes Asia a major player more than the Middle East a major player.
You hear candidates and presidents and other politicians spending a lot more time, it seems to me, talking about terrorism in the Middle East than you do about Asia and particularly even North Korea or China. But since you have, Dr. Fever, behind-the-scenes experience at the White House, is that what's going on there? Are they spending an equal amount of time or maybe even a greater amount of time concentrating on what's going on in the East?
Well, one of the things that President Obama came into office trying to do was trying to rebalance the portfolio of attention and resources away from the Middle East. He thought we were over-invested in the Middle East, meaning the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and other conflicts there, towards greater investment of presidential time and economic and military resources into the Pacific. This was called the Asia Pivot. Now, he exaggerated greatly what he was going to do and how he was going to be able to do it and how different this was from the previous administration, because, of course, most of the lines of engagement in Asia predated Obama. They indeed predated President Bush. There's been a bipartisan emphasis on Asia from Clinton to Bush to Obama, and Obama just continued on that trajectory. But rhetorically, he gave it much greater emphasis and talked about shifting away from the Middle East to Asia. So it's a definite hallmark of rhetorically, it's a hallmark of this presidency. The problem is he discovered that you can't walk away from problems in the Middle East and face Asia and without those problems in the Middle East coming back to bite you. And so we're back now in the Middle East in much greater numbers than President Obama expected we would be by this point in his tenure.
Well, as I said in the beginning, the next president will be the third president to preside over an ongoing war in the Middle East. We have been at war in Afghanistan for I'm not sure how long, to be honest with you, but 10 years or more. President Obama declared 2 years ago that U.S. combat operations were over there, but we can't seem to withdraw. And if we did withdraw, it seems the whole thing would fall apart. This is the longest war in American history, and yet none of the candidates are really talking about it. Is that wise?
It's not a matter of just the longest war. We've had wars on poverty and wars on hunger, and then
drugs.
We declared a war on terror and wars on drugs. You're right. We declared a war on terror. That's the least able to start or finish because you have no clear enemy. You have no clear ability to be able to declare you've won and defeated all those options. A war on drugs is still ongoing. The war on poverty is ongoing. The war on hunger is ongoing. These things.
But bombs aren't falling.
But that's the difference.
And
the war on terror, we've engaged in actual military conflict,
right,
which is not the case in the others. So that creates a genuine war. Have we declared war on Afghanistan?
No.
No. Have we declared war on Iraq?
No.
Have we declared a war on Syria?
I don't think we've declared war since Korea.
We haven't. And the difficulty is once you declare a war on terror, but you haven't designated where it is you will actually be fighting, and then you use military to engage in it, you've changed your actions without changing which rules you're following.
Well, that brings up something else that is a running theme in all presidential campaigns, and that is how to use, when to use, how often to use the military and how to make it stronger. Donald Trump has called for a massive expansion of the military, his words. Is that the answer? Do we really have effective military options in either Asia or the Middle East?
There's no military-only solution in any of these theaters, but there's also no diplomatic solution without a strong military component to it. And so you need both. You need the military in order to make the diplomacy work. And so it's not a surprise that both candidates, both Secretary Clinton and Donald Trump, are talking about rebuilding the military and making implicit, in the case of Clinton, and explicit, in the case of Trump, criticisms of how far the military has been cut, how the far the defense budget has been cut under President Obama. You need a strong military in order to make diplomacy work in these theaters. That's the bottom line, and both experts in both parties recognize
well,
that.
Well, do we spend too much time talking about the president's role as commander-in-chief and not enough time as to talking about the president's role, although it's really the Secretary of State's role, I suppose, in diplomacy, but he guides that role. The Secretary of State operates under directives of the president. Do we spend too much time talking about or concentrating on the commander-in-chief aspect of the president's job?
It's not a matter of too much time. He's right. Peter's right in saying we need a balance. To be able to have effective diplomacy, you have to be able to speak with a firm voice that can effectively force what you're saying to be taken seriously. There is no international army that enforces international law. The UN makes resolutions, but there's no way to enforce it without some kind of external force. So if you say to someone, you must do this, you have to be able to make it real. You stop the stop signs because they're police. If you're going to make states stop breaking the rules in the international community against their own people or against a neighbor, you have to be able to make your threats effective. And although sanctions are reasonable, they usually take 20 years or more to do some difference. So the lack of strength in military can be a serious handicap.
Peter Feaver, you spent a lot of time, I believe, in 2005 and 6 in the Bush administration working on that administration's Iraq strategy. It was vitally important at the time. Later, President Bush would decide to draw down troops, and President Obama would follow through on that promise. With shifting attention to Afghanistan, both those countries are still problems, and yet we've also witnessed the rise of ISIS and the civil war in Syria. Are we doing anything more than playing whack-a-mole over there? Will the next president have more or fewer options, more or fewer conflicts to face in that area?
Well, sadly, the next president is going to inherit a geopolitical situation that is more unstable than what President Obama inherited in 2009.
Is that President Obama's fault, or is that just the circumstances that have evolved over time?
Well, I think historians are going to be debating that for decades. I think enough of it is President Obama's fault for it to make sense to see what he did and didn't do and try to correct it. But some of it is that we're dealing with problems that are generational in nature and going to take generations to address. The problem, we're still in Europe 70 years after World War II. The deployments in Europe were designed to prevent World War II from happening again. I'm talking about NATO and our commitment to Germany and France basically help provide European stability. That was designed to prevent another World War II, and we've been at it for 70 years. It's been largely a success story, and it's sustainable. We can afford it. We're a very wealthy country. So the level of commitment that will be required in the Middle East is sustainable in financial terms. The question is whether politically the leaders are willing to make the case for it. And I think the next president is going to have to make the case for a more sustainable, enduring commitment than President Obama thought he would have to make.
I only have a minute left in this segment. I think you have a slight disagreement with Dr. Feaver.
I do, Peter. I know that you have experience in the White House in these contexts, but Obama inherited two wars, which he did not instigate, either in Afghanistan or Iraq. And the consequence of that was, in effect, the disintegration that's occurring in Syria, because that was al-Qaeda in Iraq, which emerged as ISIS out of Syria and northern Iraq. We created, or basically, shall we say, helped to implement two failed states, Afghanistan and Iraq.
What about Libya?
And now you're looking at Libya, also still not recovered enough to be called a real state, still hovering on the edge of failure, and Syria going in that direction. That's not his fault.
We have to stop. We'll come back and talk more about this and other issues that the next president may face in a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the UNC Charlotte College of Arts and Architecture, presenting Heightened Perspective 1, opening Friday at the Projective Eye Gallery at UNC Charlotte Center City. Details at arts.uncc.edu. And Firehouse Casual Living Stores, serving the Carolinas for nearly 40 years with branded outdoor patio seating and dining furniture. Showrooms located on Johnston Road and W.T. Harris Boulevard. Details at fhcasual.com. Members of more than 200 Native American tribes expand protests across the country over the construction of a controversial oil pipeline from North Dakota to Illinois. What's next in the fight over the Dakota Access Pipeline and a renewed debate over tribal rights? The topic of the conversation in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on The Diane Rehm Show. If you'd like to join our conversation, now's your time. You can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org, search for WFAE on Facebook, or get to us through Twitter.
Presidential elections are historic, and All Things Considered has brought you 4 decades of election coverage.
Regardless of how you vote, I urge each of you to vote.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
We're going to choose the last president of the 20th century and the first president of the 21st century.
I, Barack Hussein Obama, do solemnly swear.
Once again, this election year, we bring you the political news of the day with perspective. Listen every afternoon.
From 4 to 6:30 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins with Dr. Cindy Combs from UNC Charlotte, where she is a political science professor and an expert on the Middle East. Dr. Peter Fever, professor of political science at Duke University, director of the Triangle Institute for Security Studies, and worked in the Clinton and George W. Bush White Houses in the national security arena. Terrorism is a very broad category. It ranges from acts of groups like Al-Qaeda and ISIS to lone wolves who act on their own, sometimes because they are copycats, sometimes because they want to become part of these bigger organizations, or sometimes because they are actually working with those organizations and have been told to act as a lone wolf. In many cases, a president cannot use his or her powers as commander-in-chief because it would be inappropriate to use the military to respond or even prevent these terrorist events. So what then become the options? Is it all, how do you plan for these events? Is it all spycraft? Is it work by police departments? What is it? How do you do it?
Well, this is an area where there has been bipartisan consensus and cooperation over the last 15 years. We have a much more robust counterterrorism effort today than we did on, you know, September 10th, 2001. And many of the impediments and problems that made the 9/11 attacks so difficult to prevent have been addressed. So in that sense, we are safer today than we were then.
And yet, there was an article in the Washington Post recently headlined, 15 years after 9/11, the jihadist threat looms larger than ever across the globe. Is that in spite of our efforts or because of them?
No, that's the second. That's the other half of the coin, which is that the threat from the other side, from the enemy, is greater today, but our efforts are also greater, and it's a multi-layered response.
But are we the gas on the flame?
Some argue that. I don't find that very persuasive because the 9/11 attacks were aimed at us for basic reasons of our foreign policy. So you say we're gas in the flame. If the U.S. disappeared today, would they still want to attack the United States? Well, no, we wouldn't exist. But would they still want to attack the West? Yes, they still would want to attack the West. They are opposed to the global order, which is backed up by the United States and by our Western allies. And until that is upended, they will be hostile to us. But to confront it, you have to have a multi-layered. In your setup, you asked, is it all diplomacy? Is it all law enforcement? Is it all military? It's not all any one of those. It's all of those things together. There's a military dimension. There's a diplomatic dimension. There's a law enforcement dimension. And what we're doing much better today is integrating them. We're by no means perfectly safe, but we're doing a better job of integrating counterterrorism efforts than we used to.
Are you on the same page, Cindy Combs?
Up to a certain point, you're right in terms of the fact that we're doing better in all of those three levels. You're missing one. One of the biggest issues and the reason why both ISIS is currently recruiting successfully and Al-Qaeda is done is that the West has not understood Islam. And we have not made it clear that we are not in conflict with Christianity and Islam are both people of the book. We should be focusing on helping the people.
President Obama has repeatedly said that this is not a war on Islam.
No, and that's true. What I'm saying is, as a community, as a country.
On the other hand, he is also refusing to say that the phrase Islamic. What's the phrase they want him to say? The Republicans want him to say Islamic extremist.
Extremist. Yes.
He won't say that either. So.
Because realistically, it is not Islamic. Most of the Islamic leaders reject both ISIS and Al-Qaeda's tenets. They go back and point out that this is not what is in the Quran. This is what is in the Hadith instead. It is not actually a part of the basic Quran. It is twisted pieces, just like some things like the Christian Identity Movement gave Timothy McVeigh the reason to go and blow up the federal building.
You don't paint a very hopeful picture about this Middle Eastern conflict because, Cindy Combs, you have said that no president is going to be able to solve the war on terror. You also say that the nature of the war on terror continues to evolve. It doesn't have a clear end, and we still haven't set up good, clear goals. Really? Didn't we have benchmarks in Iraq and Afghanistan, when it would be over, when we would start withdrawing troops?
And how close were we to those benchmarks? How close are we to solving
the problem?
We stopped
combat,
yes, but we haven't stopped having troops either in Afghanistan or in Iraq. We are still having bombings occur in Afghanistan. I have a former student, the one who was on here before, Matt Smither, who's over there working with a Development Assistance International in Kabul, and there are bombs exploding near where he's working with State Department contracts there. We still have citizens and military in both of those places.
But they're not our bombs. Are they?
They're not our. I have no way of knowing. At this point, nobody's claiming, per se, a lot of the bombings. The difficulty is you can set parameters on, look, we'll have succeeded as long as we get this number out. If we take the troops out but send advisors in who are also in uniform, what's the difference? We make claims that we will get out of Afghanistan. We are out. We aren't completely. We'll be out of Iraq. We aren't. And neither is stable. So you'll leave them and leave them as failed states. How does that solve it?
And Dr. Fever, you alluded to that a little while ago. We never leave. We're still in Japan from World War II. We're still in Germany. We're everywhere. We never leave. Is that a mistake?
No, I don't think our troop deployment in Europe is a mistake by any reasonable cost-benefit calculation. This has been a great investment in global stability. I'm talking about our NATO commitment. And so where it becomes problematic is where we're in active combat indefinitely. That is not sustainable. And it's important to remember the snapshot that you're looking at today. The situation is very bleak. But the situation in Iraq was much brighter in 2009, 2010, indeed so bright that Vice President Biden was talking about boasting that Iraq would be seen as the administration's great success story because of the progress that was done in Iraq. There has been progress. What happened is we lost the progress over the last 4 years. We took some decisions decided not to do other things, and as a consequence, the enemy was able to regain the initiative. But there is ways of producing sustainable stability, something far less than the ideal, but definitely sustainable stability. But it requires American leadership, and this is where we get back to your first question: are the candidates adequately talking about this? And there, I think Cindy and I would agree, neither candidate yet is adequately talking and preparing the American people for what it would really mean to confront these challenges.
Up to a point, you're right. I have problems with the idea that what is happening in Iraq is something that was a sort of a stumble. We changed policy. You realize that what happened in Iraq when we took Hussein down is what was told to George Bush Sr., told him, don't march on Baghdad and topple the regime, because these 10 things, and they gave him the list of what would happen in terms of the instability that would happen in Iraq and would not be solvable by Iraq themselves and would require a great deal more and long-term intervention, and he stepped back. His son did not step back and went ahead and moved for the idea of toppling Hussein, and what was told then 10 years before came through. So we're dealing with what we knew for 20 years would be the consequence if we did this. So there's a sense in which, yes, we make progress and it stabilizes a little. But what they said in terms of the instability that would occur and would continue to occur and would require long-term commitments was true.
Okay, let's look forward and not backward, because that's water under the bridge. Because of this ongoing conflict now in Syria, which is all part of the whole mess over there, we find ourselves, the United States finds itself once again seemingly pitted against Russia, although we've had a little detente in the last couple of days. When you combine that, what's going, what they're doing in Syria versus what we're doing in Syria, and combine that with their aggression in Ukraine, it seems like a replay of the Cold War. Is that something we anticipated or could have anticipated?
Well, the administration was warned about this, and here's what makes the politics very interesting. While Secretary Clinton was Secretary of State, she warned the president not to abandon Iraq entirely. She wanted to stay in Iraq after 2011. President decided otherwise, and she the things she warned about that would happen if he left Iraq, they came to pass. So she can feel somewhat vindicated in her warnings. Unfortunately, of course, she, as Secretary of State, bears some of the consequences. So politically, it may not work for her. But one of the warnings was, if we just leave the civil war in Syria to fester, it's not going to get better. It's going to become a power vacuum that will draw in other conflicts, other great power ambitions. And precisely that happened with Russia. Now, could we have forestalled that? Would more decisive action by the United States earlier in 2011, 2012, 2013, would that have prevented Russia from getting involved? We'll never know for sure, but certainly the president was warned about it. And so when it happened, it was coming to pass of a warning.
Donald Trump has praised Vladimir Putin's effectiveness as a leader. He went on Russian state television to talk about that and to say some negative things about our generals. At least, I guess his point was our generals have been crushed by the administration. Many people believe that hurts us because it plays into the hands of a dictator. But could it be a strategy to find a way to reasonably cozy up to Putin if Donald Trump wins?
Well, if that's the strategy, it's likely to backfire. So I think it's more likely that Vladimir Putin is playing Trump than that Donald Trump is playing Putin.
You are, if I'm not misquoting you here, you are one of those people who believe that Donald Trump is, and I quote here, an inept candidate, manifestly unfit to be president. You wrote about that for foreignpolicy.com. Why is he unfit in your mind?
Well, it's not just that he starts with a low knowledge base on foreign policy, national security matters. Many candidates, when they start out, don't have a background in foreign policy. But as far as I can tell, he's done very little to bone up on foreign policy and national security. There's not the normal evolution and growth in a candidate that you would see over someone who's running for president for so long. And it's striking that when Matt Lauer asked him that question, framed that way, what are you doing now to prepare, I found Trump's answer unsatisfying. And so I think he has not done the work. I think he actually believes, as he said at one point, that he understands ISIL better than the generals. I think he has overconfidence in his ability. So that's one line of critique. And then, of course, there's another line having to do with temperament.
He also has said, yes, he told this to Matt Lauer, that he wasn't going to lay out and be specific about certain plans because he doesn't want the enemy to know what he's going to do. There's something to be said for that, I suppose. But he's been remarkably undetailed about almost everything.
Up to a point, that's true. He had said that he had a plan to get rid of ISIS, to handle it,
right.
But he was not going to reveal it. But in the last week, he's basically said it's actually the generals who have the plan, and he's waiting for them to put it together and give it to him. And part of that's accepting the idea that he doesn't actually know as much as he thinks he does on it, and part of it's a way of potentially of shifting the blame, if it doesn't work, to someone else.
To be fair, because I've quoted you on your opinion about Donald Trump, Peter Fever, the article I read that you and Will Inboden wrote in August was headlined, "Never Trump and Never Hillary Clinton Either."
Right.
Is that based on her stance on trade and domestic issues, including how her presidency might change the Supreme Court, or do you have foreign policy and military commander-in-chief concerns as well?
Well, to be clear, I don't get to write the headline, you know, in the business. So
right.
I would have used a slightly different headline, what we said in there was that we weren't going to vote for Trump, but nor were we going to vote for Secretary Clinton. If you're just talking foreign policy, national security, and you just look at Secretary Clinton, the record is not great. Where she was right on the issues, she didn't have much influence in the administration. And where she had a lot of influence, it hasn't turned out well. She was the prime mover on the Libyan intervention, and that has turned out to be a disaster. And so her record on foreign policy is not nearly as good as her backers claim it is. There's some serious questions raised about the handling of classified emails, about conflicts of interest with the Clinton Foundation. So just narrowly in terms of national security foreign policy, you would have serious doubts about her. And any regular Republican candidate, any of the other 14 or 15 that were running, would probably have a decisive advantage on her. In comparison to Trump, she looks better. But then there's, of course, all the rest that the president has to do, and then I have concerns about her agenda in those areas as well.
Hillary Clinton has talked about a continuation of President Obama's strategy, which many see as a failure. Is it a failure, Cindy Combs? And if so, how should a President Clinton or a President Trump change things?
I don't think Obama's has been a failure any more than any president's whole policy net is a failure. There are errors he's made, and I'm hoping they're ones that she will decide that can be adjusted and corrected. I'd rather have her take the good parts of what was done and add to them and change the other pieces. I agree with Peter in the sense that I think Trump is not qualified, lacking the international experience, the understanding of countries and how you deal with political leaders, the ability to understand foreign policy, not generated just by military or by himself, but the context in which it works, is a serious issue. And to have a president who could cause serious damage to all of our allies by foolish statements that he can then adjust later is not a happy thought.
And I have 20 seconds here. Trump talks a lot about defeating ISIS. If he or another president were able to do that, would that just eliminate ISIS with something else sprouting up in its place?
Yes, when we managed to bring al-Qaeda to a large degree to a much more slower pace and almost gone, you have ISIS that sprung out of that. You saw that in Northern Ireland. You had IRA to the PRA to the CRA. That'll happen.
Dr. Cindy Combs, Professor of Political Science at UNC Charlotte. Dr. Peter Fever, Professor of Political Science at Duke University and Director of Triangle Institute for Security Studies. Thank you both for the hour.
My pleasure.
Thank you.